Welcome to the Dietitian Rehab Podcast, where we not only challenge and inspire dietitians to think outside the traditional dogmatic education, training, and attitudes for a mind wide open, but also to challenge anyone to think differently about their own health. We'll talk all things food, health, and nutrition related as we explore points of view, evidence, and strategies for better health that will allow you a fuller understanding of the hot topics that everybody's talking and asking about. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Before we get started, I just have a small announcement to make. I have rebranded the name of the podcast from Dietitian Rehab to Pursuing Health. And the reason for this is the original name I don't feel worked. I don't feel it's resonating with the goal of the podcast, which is really one of exploring all things health related, regardless of topic, talking to experts of all kinds. And the reason I named the first podcast, or rather the podcast with the original title, Dietitian Rehab, is it was my journey to rehab or detox from dietetic education, kind of letting go of those shackles, and through that, exploring these things of interest. But the reality is most people still thought it and saw it to be a podcast by a dietitian for dietitians talking about dietitian issues. So I've rebranded. It's now called Pursuit of Health. And we're going to talk about anything and everything that's of interest and I hope of interest to you. And on that note, if you could take the time, if you like the show, go to any of the directories that you are listening to this podcast through, rate it and leave a review. That would be greatly appreciated. And also, if you really like it, you can go to my website under podcasts on any of the episodes and click on the Buy Me a Coffee button. And that's just to offer small support to allow me to bring this content to you. So with that, we'll move on to today's topic and introduce today's guest, who is Dr. Andrew Hill. And he's one of the top neurofeedback practitioners and peak performance coaches in the country, the USA. He holds a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA's Department of Psychology and continues to do research on attention and cognitive performance. Dr. Hill is the founder of Peak Brain Institute and is the host of the Head First podcast with Dr. Hill and has lectured at UCLA, having taught courses in psychology, neuroscience, and gerontology. And today we'll be talking about a very interesting topic around this idea of brain mapping and how that can help with neurofeedback, improving cognition, improving mood, reducing stress, etc. So with that, we'll get on with the show.
So Dr. Hill, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you today, not only because I work in mental health and addictions, but because brain health is really taking off in terms of an area of interest from a general health point of view, but of course, from a performance point of view. And I think you're going to be a great expert to kind of, pardon the pun, pick your brain about, to talk about cognition, performance, and all those kinds of things. But before we get into that, I'm just wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you became interested specifically in neuroscience as a field and topic of interest.
Sure. So I guess I've always been one of those people that likes to understand how things work and would take things apart as a kid. And, you know, people are really complex. And while I don't take people apart, certainly, you know, that's the surgeon, I guess, path. If you follow medicine, that leads you, that desire to understand and get deeply and fix might lead you to surgery. For me, it led me into neuroscience because to some extent, the brain is one of the last unexplored frontiers that we just don't really deeply understand. I mean, we have phenomenological understanding, I would say, of the brain more than we do have discrete understanding of how the tissue produces our experience. So it was a fascinating area for me to get into sort of in theory, but had some personal experiences when I was growing up. My younger brother sustained a head injury. We were sledding in the winter and he sledded into the street, got hit by a car and had a coma and some loss of tissue and some subsequent symptoms. You know, he was in a coma for several weeks and had a obviously dramatic change in consciousness that kind of caught my attention as a eighth grader or whatever I was. He ended up being largely fine. So there's a happy story there, but I ended up working in mental health across every aspect of acute, you know, mental health you can imagine. So while I'm not a psychologist now and a clinical psychologist, I have worked with group homes for multiply disabled adults who had no language and had, you know, CP and developmental disabilities and all kinds of complex issues with communication. I've worked with people in addiction and dual diagnosis units, mix of mental health and addiction, substance abuse. I've worked in crisis, psychiatric inpatient locked facilities with some of the worst funded, highest violence rate hospitals in the Northeast. I've done a lot of work with gerontology in both inpatient and outpatient. I've taught gerontology about a dozen years at UCLA. I taught gerontology, peak aging and how to basically understand the process of aging and the sort of womb to tomb life course perspective on aging. It's not about being old. It's about the, you know, developmental process. And then all through all that, I saw brains change. And I ended up pursuing a PhD at UCLA after I got into working with autism. So I was working before that in all kinds of pretty severe childhood and developmental things, even with adults. Like I was running a group home for a while for four or five adults that had no language among them. I think half were deaf, half were blind, some were both. Most had mobility issues. They all had communication issues and cognitive issues. So it was a very challenging edge case, if you will, of human brains. And I had done this on top of other, you know, really serious edge case stuff. And then I ended up getting injured working in a psychiatric facility and couldn't do the sort of dynamic hands-on, you know, training kind of in the psych hospital kind of role I was doing. And I ended up going to high tech for a while, missed humans to some extent, and went back into working with humans in a way where I could use my new high tech skills that I'd picked up for a couple of years, and ended up in an autism focused center because I'd heard about this thing called neurofeedback or biofeedback in the brain. I'm kind of curious about it for a while, and working, of course, in acute, both inpatient, outpatient, developmental, et cetera, you see brains across just a huge range of functional, you know, statuses and impacts and bottlenecks and all kinds of things and suffering. And my big approach, my big takeaway rather, from working in mental health across those different domains was that we weren't really good at doing much. I didn't work in a therapeutic one-on-one, you know, talk environment. I didn't help people facilitate personal change. I worked in the trenches of the system, so to speak, where most people were in holding patterns. Even psychiatric facilities would, you know, take people in for 3, 4, 5 days, 11 days, and then be back a month later, revolving door kind of stuff. So when I got into autism work in Providence, Rhode Island, at a place called the Neurodevelopment Center, I was kind of shocked because it was a mix of mostly autism, a little ADHD, some anxiety stuff, and a, you know, child and adolescent developmental population. And I was really surprised because what I was seeing was change. ADHD symptoms dropping away in a few weeks and autism shifting. I was like, this is not what my experience with big developmental things, that they change much and certainly not quickly. Seizure rates dropping, anxiety and trauma things, you know, being addressed over weeks and months, not years and decades. So this was a little counter to my understanding of both how the systems of the brain worked and how psychology, the practice of psychology and critical care of the mind worked. And so with this sort of perspective, I started digging into the mechanisms a bit more deeply. And I had an undergraduate degree, a bachelor's degree, a psych/neuroscience bachelor's anyway. So, you know, I could read literature and was interested in this stuff broadly. And what I found at the time was there was 3 or 4 different schools of thought of neurofeedback, maybe 20 years ago. And the field of neurofeedback is over 50 years old. It's maybe 60 years old. But 20 years ago, it was in somewhat robust practice here and there, you know, a few thousand practitioners in the U.S. And what I discovered was that there was what I call a blind men and elephant situation. Everyone had really serious ideas about what they were doing, and those ideas were not reconcilable, but yet we were all getting great results. So, you know, after getting into the field of neurofeedback and brain training for a couple of years and seeing this conflict in the sort of field, but seeing great results everywhere, results that far surpassed my expectations from what I had understood previously about what we could do with brains. So I had to go back and get a PhD because I had to reconcile, I had to dig into the mechanisms, I had to figure out what was happening at the brain level a bit better. My goal was ultimately sort of making this accessible because I had a personal experience with neurofeedback that was quite profound. And I decided that, all right, this thing doesn't need to be siloed in the, you know, hands of psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, mental health practitioners. It shouldn't be behind insurance paywalls. It's never been well covered by insurance anyways. And the insurance companies have actually actively worked to poison the well against neurofeedback for 40 years or something. So it's been kept in this little niche space. And seeing that and seeing what it could do, I sort of made it my mission to go get a degree figuring out the sort of intersection of this technology, the mind-brain, EEG, behavior, performance kind of intersection. as it applied to the things that I knew best, which at the time were attention and anxiety and sleep, these regulatory features that are often bottlenecked in these, in cognitive suffering, so to speak. The process of getting the PhD sort of helped me figure out some of my own ideas about how to make neurofeedback accessible, replicable, and make it more of a personal training process. And then I've moved from the PhD into more of an entrepreneurial perspective instead of an academic. So I taught for many years. I taught gerontology and psychology and neuroscience, but I moved on into a focus on bringing technology and tools to individuals, basically. And so I opened Peak Brain. Well, first an addiction center. So this will be near and dear to your heart, that I opened an addiction center with some other addiction professionals. I'm not an addiction professional explicitly, but I worked with Drs. Mark Kern, who's the habit doc. He wrote the manual for the moderation management. He was involved with the Smart Recoveries board when they first started. And then Dr. Adi Jaffe, who's a sort of moderation-focused, agency-focused addiction specialist who's a bit younger and guys shaking up the industry a little bit, trying to change how we think about addiction. So with those gentlemen and a mindfulness guy named Karash Rasek, we all created this program called Alternatives in Beverly Hills for a few years. We worked on bringing individual people lots of tools and constructing, bespoke programs of transformation. And we found amazing results on addiction clients, certainly, but I also ran another sort of side of the company that just saw straight brain, if you will, needs. And the side that was just brain and not specifically addiction kind of outgrew the rest of the company pretty quickly. And after a couple of years, maybe 3 years, we split off into our own company called Peak Brain. And then we've opened in several cities around the US. We also have, at this point, it's about a 3/4 to 1/4 ratio. About 3/4 of our clients train from home. So you can do brain training, brain mapping, neurofeedback with coaches live from Peak Brain from the comfort of your home or your forest floor or your wherever you like to do it. So that's the journey, I guess. That's a long-winded answer. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a long journey. So how many, just to help me put some of these things in context, over what time period? 10, 20 years?
So I started my PhD in 2005. I finished in 2012 and I opened up Alternatives, which is the addiction / brain center, two different companies really tied together. And then Peak Brain opened up in 2015. So Peak Brain's been open for 5 years. And I probably started in the field of neuroscience around, I got my bachelor's in neuroscience in 93, I think. And then worked in acute mental health the next maybe 11 or 12 years before I got my grad degree. So I'm missing a little gap there. For anyone who hasn't gotten the grad degree and is thinking about it, you can go back at 35. It's fine. What else are you going to do? You're still going to be that much older 5-10 years later.
Right, right. So this is, I'm including your undergrad. So this is like a 27.
I'm pushing 50. So I started my undergrad in 89. So over 30 years for me for a neuroscience track, yeah.
Yeah, so this is quite an interesting span because I'm new to mental health and addiction. I only started working, the hospital I work at, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, CAMH is the acronym. So that's only 8 years ago. So this is a time when I've always said to people that, to quote you, I've said this as well, it's the last frontier. Mental health is the last frontier, partly, I guess, because of history, right? It's been stigmatized, but partly because we don't measure the brain like you can measure blood sugar and cholesterol. It's hard to measure. We have scanning, but it's still, we don't know what's going on at the neuron level. You can correct me on that. But you've been seeing huge, you were there through the whole change from the late 80s because there's been huge changes. So the other thing that stands out to me, and I've interviewed a psychiatrist, I don't know if you know Drew Ramsey or heard of that name.
It definitely rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, so he's, and the psychiatrists at work with whom I work say, we haven't really been able to do a lot with people. So, because medications are quite limiting. So you've been part of this seismic shift because it's a lot different today than it was in the late 80s, early 90s. So you've kind of seen it grow. So are we better at being able to help people?
Vastly.
Vastly.
Vastly good. Better. We're much less good at providing systems so people can get access to help than we were 20 years ago. When I started working at a hospital, which has since closed in Western Mass called Charles River Hospital West in Holyoke or Chicopee, really quite impoverished area, the average length of inpatient stay approved by the insurance company when someone came in crisis, psychiatric major crisis, was usually 11 days. And for most of these crisis things, you need about that time for the meds to sort of kick in, figure out what's working, get them stabilized, et cetera. You need at least a week usually. And some meds, of course, antidepressants, At that point, you needed 3 to 5 weeks generally to figure out if they were working, you know, minimum. That was the window. It was a tough window, but it was done. I worked at this hospital, Charles River Hospital West, for 4 years before they closed because of shifting, you know, insurance payments, essentially. But at the end of that time, they're reimbursing or pre-approving 3 days, sort of max, for inpatient. And that was the big shift as all the big blue insurances stopped paying, as there was, you know, state big, huge shifts away from supported mental health care, basically. And it collapsed the field a little bit. And the neurofeedback field was very nascent at that point. I mean, it's been around again since 1967, basically, as a field. There was neurofeedback happening in the 50s in Canada, some military stuff. But I think Doug Quirk was doing work in Canada. You can look him up. He's worked with incarcerated felons. He found you could reverse the recidivism rate. The 1 year reincarceration rate was reversed. It was flipped from like 2/3 down to 1/3 or something, or 3/4 down to 1/4 after some neurofeedback. But and that was in the late 50s, I believe. But in the late 60s, that's when the field of neurofeedback kind of took off. And simultaneously, Joe Camille, I think, at Northern California UCSF, although don't quote me, might have been Berkeley, he was doing human alpha neurofeedback. And that was like in the late 60s, alpha, relaxation. And it was cool stuff. And we've learned a lot about alpha ever since. But alpha neurofeedback, in some ways, can be kind of weak tea. And so while we had these devices in the 70s and 80s, I took one apart in the late 70s from Radio Shack that you put your fingers in and it got your little, you know, galvanic skin response, whatever else. We didn't really understand necessarily what brain waves were on a deep level at that point. We're just starting to. And Sterman was, to give you the story about how the field kind of erupted, if you will, or bloomed, it's probably a better metaphor. So NASA went to Dr. Sterman at UCLA in 1960, you know, 5 or 6 or something, and said, hey, astronauts are getting sick breathing in rocket fuel. Could you please figure out if this stuff is really dangerous? So being the 60s, we did a lot of animal research, dose-dependent studies. Sterman had cats as his subject pool. He was a learning scientist, a lot of conditioning work, a lot of, you know, Skinner / Pavlovian cross stuff. He was, you know, looking at reward intervals and reinforcement rates and lots of cool things like that. Really cool, you know, basic deep learning to understand how learning, associative learning, really works. Well, he said, sure. And, you know, I think he had another grant on learning from NASA. So he did this dose-dependent study from them. And he took 32 cats and he put one at a time, he put them in a plexiglass cage with a little beaker of methylhydrazine, you know, rocket fuel, which would vaporize to the air, and started a stopwatch and watched the symptoms increase. And 24 of the 32 cats had a perfect dose-dependent linear curve where increased minutes meant increased symptoms. Vocalizing, drooling, ataxia, so stumbling and dizziness and things. And it just kept going up and it was seizure, coma, death. You know, it just kept going up and that was it. And around 40 minutes in, 45 minutes in, about an hour, that's when all the cats were having seizures, you know, within an hour. But 8 of the cats refused this pattern completely. And about 2.5 hours in, they were showing a little bit of ataxia, instability events in the brain. But they weren't having like major seizures. They weren't, you know, falling over. They weren't convulsing. They weren't going into like, you know, death throes. It was really quite brutal, of course, but you know, 60s animal research. We don't do this anymore. So Sterman couldn't figure out what the heck was going on because 3/4 of the cats had a perfect response and 1/4 of them refused to have seizures, basically. And he remembered that these 8 cats had been used in a previous experiment 6 months prior for operant conditioning. And he simply put a little eyedropper in their cheek. And whenever they made a certain brainwave, he squirted chicken broth into their mouth as a reward, you know, an operant reward. And he found that these cats who'd had their SMR, their specific brainwave that cats make a lot of, and I'll explain it if you like in a minute. These cats who'd had their brain trained up for a few days to increase SMR, and they showed they could increase it when it was rewarded, they were seizure resistant months later. So his lab assistant was a seizure, it was a medication uncontrolled epileptic, Klonopin, Meberol, Tegretol, all kinds of things. Still having tens of seizures a month. Classic chronic tonic, kind of grand mal stuff. And this is somewhat life-threatening, right? So she was looking for more solutions and they built her, I think, an audio biofeedback machine, but I could be wrong. And they tinkered with it after a while. And she went off all of her meds the following couple of years, remained seizure-free for over a year. Someone who was like medication-resistant epileptic. Sterman published a metadata study in 2000 that looked at the seizure literature and neurofeedback and found the average person gets a 50% reduction in seizure incidence. 5% of people have complete control of seizures with neurofeedback. And these effects are not subtle. They don't happen gradually. They're usually quite obvious. And they just kind of linearly reduce seizures. So, and of course, cats are not really good instruction followers, right? This is not a placebo effect. This is a deep thing. And for anyone who's thinking placebo and neurofeedback, a lot of the work was initially done on nonverbal acute kids, kids with seizures, kids with massive autism. When those brains move, those brains move. You know, no autistic kid with no language who's having seizures and bedwetting and is obsessive with a sensory integration issue, flapping their hands. It's not a placebo effect when they stop flapping their hands, stop wetting the bed, stop having seizures and make eye contact suddenly after like, you know, a few weeks. That's the brain changing. So everyone's wondering why this is like, you know, sort of like how it works and why it's not more well adopted. But the placebo question always comes up. And I just have to point out that cats just aren't really good subjects. So you can't really get placebo effects for animals that way.
But also my understanding in medicine is there's always a placebo effect for any intervention. So you give pain medication, you do any kind of intervention, and that's just, A, that's part of the power of the brain, I guess, but it's not irrelevant. If you get some placebo impact, it's definitely not good.
And it can be helpful, exactly right. One of my committee, PhD committee chair members, Dr. Andrew Luchter, he's sort of one of the placebo guys, if you will, in the US. He's also done, I think he managed this big STAR-D study looking at efficacy of different antidepressants across depression, huge, massive, you know, multi-study arms. Andy did a really cool study, speaking of, I mentioned earlier, we couldn't actually get people out of hospitals rapidly enough to tell if them, you know, get the meds working rapidly enough to tell if they were going to be stabilized before they were left unsupported by the old insurance systems. Andy did some work maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that showed about a week after you start an antidepressant with a single measurement on the forehead of EEG, you can calculate something that predicts if an antidepressant is going to work 2 weeks later subjectively.
Wow.
A week in, before you experience it often. I mean, often you do experience something, but it's like a 3 to 5 week process for these SSRIs and MAOIs and, you know, that kind of stuff. And tricyclics, these are kind of a longer process. Tricyclics, of course, are faster, but they aren't used anymore for obvious reasons. So.
Yeah. So what you're saying, if I'm summarizing correctly, is that when you give antidepressants, there's going to be some kind of effect physiologically, receptors, maybe neurotransmitter metabolism, and you would expect to see that behavior. But even before that's happening, there's shifts. I mean, how do you describe consciousness and that kind of thing? But there's those measurable changes in the brain waves that are preceding other benefits that are more observable 2 or 3 yeah. weeks out.
Exactly right. So there's a frontal lobe change that seems to show up weeks before you get the classic antidepressant effect, which happens 3 to 5 weeks in for the big effects. About a week in, it looks like, from Dr. Luchter's research.
Yeah, and I've heard it put that the very act of reaching for the aspirin if you have a headache will elicit some kind of relief just because you're taking control and all that kind of stuff. So the act of taking the pill was obviously eliciting yeah. some kind of placebo effect, which is just additive. It's not just, it's to dismiss it is missing the point, I guess.
It's not just the specific intervention you think will work, but it's also the perspective of agency, right? No matter what your interventions are, if you have the perspective, even the illusion of agency, then you can tolerate anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, think about slamming your toe with a hammer versus getting a tattoo. You know, you can deal with it if you know why you're doing something. So we have this ability to handle quite a lot of suffering if we know the context, if it's enjoyable. I mean, the thrill and the heart palpations, you know, from a roller coaster ride versus being attacked are very similar. But the cognitive bias, the experience, the framing around them, you know, if you're terrified walking in a dark alley versus your heart's pounding down a roller coaster, the body's roughly doing the same thing. But your context, your sense of control, your sense of agency, your sense of like participation in it voluntarily is quite different. And I think we can handle almost anything if we understand. And that's, again, you mentioned we haven't had ways of imaging the brain that are effective. Like, we can do an expanded lipid panel, or I can, you know, look at your CRP and about your heart risks, or we can look at your heart rate variability and figure out how anxious you are and how in repair modes, you know, sympathetic, parasympathetic you are. But they're right. The brain's been a bit of a black art for a long time, a black box. The process that Dr. Luchter, I mentioned earlier, it's one specific mathematical algorithm within a field called QEEG or quantitative EEG. And the clinical practice of QEEG is just like any other clinical analysis of one person compared to others. It's a sort of Z-score or normative database driven thing. So when you look at the WISC or the WAIS, or you know, the CPT or the TOVA or the IVE or anything else you're looking at, you're always getting some sort of like bell curve compared to some, you know, somewhat arbitrary or cleaned average that you're looking at. With a brain map, we call it, or a QEEG analysis, you put a cap on someone's head and you record resting baselines for about 10 minutes, eyes closed and eyes open. The brain's very different in its modes. The circuits are very different in their activation, eyes closed and eyes open. So you can take those two things and maybe a CPT like the TOVA or the IVA or the Connors or something, which is performance, it's behavior, it's real. You know, you can describe it in a valid way. And then you have somewhat more raw data, brainwaves, how fast they are, where they are, connectivity patterns, speeds, et cetera. You compare all those things to normative databases and get Z-scores out of them. And you can tell how unusual one person is. So we have really reliable ways to look at your brain, Doug, and I could map your brain and say, hey, let's see how unusual you are. And I'd be able to say, great, here's something in your performance. You might be a little more inattentive or impulsive, or maybe it's auditory is worse than visual, or a short versus long term. That's very useful to understand. And that's a bit variable based on your feeling, if you rested, et cetera. But it's useful to tease apart your performance, I think, for most people. It gives them that agency, that perspective. But the brain is the real black box. And when I look at your brain compared to the average person your age, I can tell you often 5-10 things about yourself that are probably true. Not definitely true, not diagnostically true, but likely to be relevant for the average person who's in your position. So let me give you some examples. I mentioned the brain's in a different mode, eyes open and eyes closed. I'm sure you know this, but for those people that don't, if you close your eyes, the back of the head is the visual system. And it tends to go quiescent or idle when the eyes are closed because it's pretty expensive to keep running. And that idleness looks like a surge in alpha waves, a resting 10 hertz roughly for adults, 10 cycles per second, big rounded, slow kind of chill wave. Now, if I looked at your brain, sir, and with your eyes closed, you were not making alpha waves. It was kind of staying high in like a beta wave pattern, a more activated pattern. I would say, hey, for a lot of people, this pattern, extra beta and not as much alpha as typical when your eyes closed in the visual system, the back of the head, for a lot of people, that represents an experience of hypervigilance because the brain is not able to disengage. It's kind of like scanning the environment, preparing to visually process. Mm-hmm. So does that sound plausible? Is that valid? Are you a little hypervigilant? Oh, you are hypervigilant. Huh. Okay. Is it important? Oh, it is important. Well, great. Now you know where it is, probably enough to be operational. So the field of neurofeedback is not about the diagnostics per se because it's discriminant. They're not valid for every person, for everything. They're operational, like a personal trainer would say. Your coach would say, hey, it's fitness data, athlete. Let's go over it. Oh, here's the thing. Do you care? You do care? All right. I'll build you a plan. We'll see what happens. That's kind of what the neurofeedbacker does operationally. Many of them are therapists. Most are therapists. In Canada and the US, there's around 5,000 cumulatively. And I think that the vast majority of them are therapists. Now, of course, there's probably 5,000 chiropractors here in Los Angeles. So there's a lot of, in Toronto, there's probably a few thousand, but there's not a lot of neurofeedbackers. There are a couple of the greats in the field, actually, in Toronto, the Thompsons, a married couple, who Linda and I forget his name, but they wrote a great book on neurofeedback. They're sort of the clinical therapist types, classic, great old school neurofeedback people. But most of the field combines therapy with the brain mapping because the therapist, the skilled clinician, will learn from it, understand it, help apply operational change for the person, and help them understand themselves. So it's a lovely therapeutic relationship. It's a great way to use the tools. But I sort of have this perspective that it's not the only way to use it. And people should be looking at their brain. So if you might be like, oh yeah, I'm a little hypervigilant. Oh, it's my brain. Oh, okay. Or an even better one. Let's say that with your eyes closed, we saw the back midline of your head was high in beta waves. I would say, oh, that's interesting. For a lot of people, this is the posterior cingulate. I would explain that sort of like that's part of the default mode network that scans the environment, helps you orient around you. So let me tell you a little bit about how it might work when you're naturally sort of using it. If you're driving your car and you're scanning, around you and you suddenly like look down or you're fishing with your phone, not that you would do this, but if you did for a second, the little sense of, watch the road, it crept in and gets you to correct that behavior. That's the posterior cingulate. So if with your eyes closed, I see a little blob, a little red beta on the back midline, I would say, oh, the posterior cingulate's more active, more easily activated for you probably than the average person. For some people, the experience of that is the brain being stuck a little bit in this evaluation mode, and that can feel like rumination. You're sort of threat sensitive. You're kind of noticing the danger. You're looking for the danger. And that is a way of talking about the resource of the brain and sort of framing it as a hypothesis. Is that true? Are you a little threat sensitive? Do you chew on things? Dog with a bone with problems? Oh yeah, I am. Okay. Does it bother you a little bit? Okay. Let's see. You want to work on that? And now the person's agency. It's like looking at your x-ray going, oh, sore shoulder. Oh, that's why it hurts all the time. Instead of just having stigma around the pain, the discomfort. And the posterior cingulate has an even better metaphor here because it's very much like the lower back, right? Many humans have a low back that is somewhat painful, right? Because we're not really engineered all that well for robust upright walking for 50, 60, 80 years, whatever. And so those big muscles around the spine will spasm up around the lower back to protect the spine. And that happens when the body's challenged, when it's in danger, basically spine's in danger. And it happens to protect us. And after that, those muscles are somewhat activated, often quite strongly. It's a really strong resource activation, but it's not an especially well-regulated one, right? With a spasm muscle. And that's what the cingulate does back there. The posterior one gets stuck in a high gear, is evaluating, is kind of checking things out all the time. And when that's extreme, this is what the literature shows is high in beta in PTSD. And you'll see it most of the time in classic PTSD. Oh, eyes closed, high cingulate. Ooh, okay, this person's probably pretty threat sensitive. And you wouldn't say hot cingulate means PTSD, but you would say, oh, here's a hypothesis. I should see if this person experiences something in that circuit. Because of that one, maybe 90% of people will have some threat sensitivity if they have a giant red blob in the back midline, but maybe only half of those people will find it actually really concerning, threatening, intrusive thoughts, you know, can't sleep, kind of classic threat sensitivity stuff. And most people won't have a huge, you know, mass or necessarily have a huge massive pinch from that resource. Maybe you'll see it with a sleep issue, you know, and then you would interpret it as the brain's like fighting through a sleep issue instead, perhaps. So these become tools for people to evaluate potentially the things they already know about themselves and how those might show up in data. So again, the process of brain mapping and neurofeedback is not so much about the diagnostic, here's what's true, although we use a lot of the same tools, you know, CPT tests and interviews and histories and things sometimes. But it's about figuring out if there's operational things we can try to do. So if you had some intrusive thoughts, some PTSD, some rumination, and you want to work on it, you would simply do neurofeedback and exercise down the beta back there. And within just a few sessions, you'd start to unclench that threat sensitivity. And here's the lovely other side of neurofeedback. You wouldn't be robbed of it. So if you're suddenly in a fight or a car accident or being chased by a tiger, you'll still have the posterior cingulate fully able to ramp all the way back up. It's not tranquilized. It might be with an anxiolytic medication or something else. It's just tuned and unstuck so you can ramp it down so you don't have to ruminate and chew on the thing and be threat sensitive if you don't feel like it. You know, if you're reading a book about tigers, don't freak out about tigers. But if you're in the jungle, you can still stay alert kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, this is really fascinating to me because I guess having worked in hospitals for 22 years, and you think about the history of medicine and I guess that kind of dualistic approach, I don't know, separating mind from body and taking a reductionist approach, I guess the history of psychiatry is just kind of been born out of that kind of mechanistic lens and where you're looking at, because the mind is so unique, right? Like a broken bone is a broken bone. But consciousness, emotions, that kind of thing, we know it comes from the brain. We're assuming it comes from the brain, but then we're treating it as being broken, for lack of a better word, because there's something wrong with the neurons or whatever is generating these emotions. And then we think we can just kind of fix it with medicine. So I guess the history of psychiatry has come from a medical model. So it's going to be, the interventions are going to be primarily pharmaceutical. I might be making this up, but this seems to be the natural extension. And yet when I sit in rounds and I sit in team review and we talk about patients' progress or lack thereof and the tweaking of the medications, I think there's five classes of medications roughly, trying to talk about improvements, trying to quantify improvements in behavior as we tweak these medications. And it's a bit of a, like you ask five people, you're going to get five different answers. So I just find it very fascinating to think that a medication could really change. You talk about perseverating or focusing on something, that a medication is just going to do that. Where this to me seems, I don't want to say intuitive, but it's self-talk. That's the difference between like talk therapy and psychiatry, I guess. I mean, there's a room for both, but this is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and what you're talking about, of course, at the neuronal level, right? And psychology and therapies and more at the systems and mind level. And the issue we have is nothing tying it between. So you're right that we can't explain most of the brain. Neuroscientists cannot. Psychiatrists cannot. When psychiatrists work, they're working generally at the neuronal, you know, chemical level. You're right, absolutely right. And when psychologists work, they're usually working at the level of the mind. and not even the mind, but like the symbol systems or the learning involved in the mind or the attachment stuff, or, you know, or, I mean, there's so many different aspects of mind and learning that are utilized, if you will, by the therapy milieu. Now, what I'm trying to do is drop one level below the psychological model of the mind and the aspects and the learning and the trauma and the, you know, that label set almost, that DSM. In the US, of course, we have the DSM, which, as most people at this point know, is not really a diagnostical manual for illnesses. It's a diagnostical manual for insurance companies initially. So it has this very kind of weird way of categorizing things. It's purely about symptoms, not about causes. And that's sort of been tried to be changed in the most recent iterations, but it hasn't been changed yet. So it's still just a bucket checklist. And it's like skilled therapists, skilled psychologists know the difference between the label and, you know, the people who might fit under that heading, so to speak, to get reimbursement. What I'm trying to do is drop one level below the label and talk about the real physiology, not the cellular level stuff. Because what I can't do is connect the cells to the mind. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how to do that. What I can do is connect the systems neuroscience to the mind. So I can tell you about your posterior cingulate selecting your attention environmentally and being high when you're threat sensitive, or the anterior cingulate selecting what you're thinking about. And that gets high when you have songs stuck in your head, you bite your nails, your OCD. The joke of the front, the anterior cingulate, it's both the OCD marker. It's also the CEO marker. You can't really tell it apart. Depends if it's using you or you're using it. You know, you're a high powered Steve Jobs CEO type and it's like, you know, it's fine working for you. Or maybe it's stuck all the time and you can't not wash your hands 47 times a day, which right now is an adaptive behavior. So I can show you if you're ADHD, how much extra alpha you have compared to average for inattention, how much extra theta you might have, which is impulsivity. I can help you not think about it as a pathology because it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. Now you're a Superman. If you get your superpowers under control, they stop being kryptonite. The ADHD person is hyper-focusable, right? They can focus more than average under high stimulus or threat, novelty. That's why they're disruptive behaviorally in classrooms and relationships, because they poke boredom to create conflict, which creates intensity, which brings the ADHD brain up. That's why the kid trains their parents to yell at them and is disruptive in class and is a bad relationship partner, because conflict, it creates engagement. And that's, you know, what the ADHD person is looking for, because they're really bad at selecting internal states and they're much better at reacting to what the environment's cueing. Now, if you give that person control over their impulsivity and their inattention, one, it helps create huge life change long-term. Two, even before you actually start making change in the circuitry, before you tune it and exercise it, just the perspective. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, that's my impulsivity? Cool. Or let's say I measured your brain and you're probably, not to guess, but you're probably, you know, around 50. So I measured your brain and I saw that your alpha waves were running slower than average. Standard deviation slower. Your alpha waves were like 9 hertz. I'd say, oh, my friend, your alpha is a little slower than average. For some people, this can get in the way. Are you experiencing like a little slowed speed of processing that shows up with word finding issues first and delayed access for like names and delayed recall for little simple things? And a lot of people in their 50s and 60s will say, oh, yeah, that's a really common thing. And what you get to say to them is, oh, this is just some speed of processing. You know, oh, I see your sleep is thrown off. It might be why. You're really anxious. It might be why. But people in our 50s, 60s, we're always concerned about the cognitive thing, dementias and memory and aging. Mostly, we don't have any problems like that in our 50s and 60s. You know, mostly later, or they happen all at once because they're genetic or something in our 50s. But they usually happen much, much later and they're metabolic. So if you stay healthy metabolically, you can avoid almost all that stuff. And looking at your brain, I can tell you if your speed of processing is tanked because of your inflammation or your chemotherapy or your lack of deep sleep. I don't know why it's tanked. I may say I'm not sure why your speed of processing is slow, but this happens with low-key concussion history, chemotherapy, mold, Lyme, restless leg, apnea. And you might be like, oh yeah, a lot of apnea. Oh, okay, well, it's really getting in the way. It's slowing your speed of processing down. That's why you're having word-finding issues. Oh, now the person wears the CPAP or the BiPAP or does yoga with ujjayi breath to build muscle tone in the back of the throat and actually has agency. So the QEEG, the brain mapping, brings agency to the individual and the therapist. Therapists send people on me all the time. Hey, is this ADHD or is this anxiety? Oh, it's both. Oh, it's really anxiety or it's really ADHD. Really different therapeutic approaches, right? For those main core things you might want to work on. So
yeah, no, this is really like my mind's a bit spinning here. So this is obviously not for, or is it? I don't know. I guess it depends how how reachable, I guess, a person is in terms of where they are in some kind of mental illness. But is this mostly things like attention deficits and mood? Would it work with psychotic things like schizophrenia, depending on where they are, like the degree of it?
Yeah, it does work with schizophrenia. It doesn't work very well, meaning most things in neurofeedback work exceptionally well. And we have such a high expectation. I mean, I could give you sort of like my guesses of the average efficacy across complaint, and you would not believe me. You'd be like, no, nothing works that well. But it's ridiculous. I mean, ADHD is a near perfect case, basically. I can almost always eliminate it. Let me give you an example for ADHD, and then I'll answer the question that you actually asked. ADHD people come in on a CPT, you know, they're middle of bell curve, 100 points, 15 point standard deviations. They come in like in the 40s and 50s, you know, 2-3 standard deviations off the mean in impulsivity and in attention. You do 50 sessions of classic QEEG guided neurofeedback, and they're now coming in above the mean by a standard deviation or two. You know, 3-4 standard deviations of change against the average person in 3-4 months of training. And it's permanent usually. So you eliminate ADHD almost always. And trauma, PTSD, same kind of massive change. Sleep issues, same kind of massive change. So what I'm getting at is the things that change reliably are the things that all brains do, and that are not necessarily big disease processes. So PTSD is a specific cramped circuit, like I described earlier, in some ways. Mm-hmm. OCD is the frontal version, the anterior cingulate, in a lot of ways. ADHD is executive function motor cortex connecting to the thalamus, preventing inhibition and sensory gating. You can look at high theta, high alpha signatures of that. Now, if you train those things, if I trained your theta down and your low beta up on the motor strip, you would attend better, even if you have no difficulties with focus or attention. So this is not about necessarily going, oh, deficit, let me fill the hole. Mm-hmm. What you might think in a chemical medication metaphor, it's, oh, hey, here's some resources. What do you want to do? And so just that perspective, again, gives people a lot of agency. And then the neurofeedback process, the exercise on the brainwaves, can make multiple standard deviations of change. And the rule of thumb generally is the worse things are, the faster they change. So when I get, you know, veterans coming back with intrusive classical PTSD like you read about, and I give some free services away, I can't get them to finish a 40-session, 3-month program because halfway in, they're feeling incredible. And I've mapped their brain and showed them all the change. And they're like, Doc, I'm taking 2 buses to get here. I'm back at home with my wife. Do I have to keep coming in? Like, you're feeling fine? No, but you know, 20 sessions probably won't stick. I mean, if you need more, you know, but it just dials it all down dramatically. You know, or seizure. I have a kid a couple of years ago who came in with a genetic disorder. She was having 50 drop seizures a minute sometimes, like just constant drop seizures, you know, every few seconds. And a good week for her in history was something like, you know, only having 10 or 20 or 30 an hour. That was like a good, when a medication worked well for a while or something. And we trained her for a few weeks and she was down to having like 3 or 4 an hour within a few weeks. And her parents slept all night long for the first time they ever slept basically since she was born. And the girl slept in her 12-year life through the night for the first time ever from then on pretty much. Like, these are huge life-changing things. Yes, the girl still had a lot of developmental issues and she was still having seizures, but just ratcheting down that acute problem and giving people control, because all brains are good at suppressing seizures. Teach the brain how to do the thing it's a little stuck on or out of shape in, and it's really sticky. It really, really helps regulate that way. Schizophrenia, it's a disease process. It's degenerative in some ways. It has a progressive thing. So while a lot of people I know, therapists, have worked with schizophrenia and neurofeedback, my takeaway here is if you stop doing neurofeedback, the schizophrenia progresses. And that is not true about most things. It's not true of the sleep, attention, stress, mood, just the general landscape of regulatory features that all human brains do. Those things stick really well for the most part.
And so obviously there's elements of, we're talking about anxiety, but there's obviously overlap with depression. So it works good with attention, anxiety, maybe depression.
Well, with all forms of attention and even forms of attention that aren't like ADHD, but like, you know, cognitive issues from a brain injury or inflammation or chemotherapy and brain chemo fog, chemo brain, yeah. Amazing results for most people. Depression's a hard one. I mean, yes, it works really well with depression, but it's not a slam dunk. Like if you give me 100 people with ADHD, I'll just turn out like 95, 97 people reliably 3-4 months later with like just soaring resources. Same thing with most forms of anxiety, OCD and PTSD included, including things like developmental trauma and severe, you know, dysregulations actually respond really rapidly. Depression? First of all, depression isn't at that mid-tier level of pure circuitry. It's a cognitive experience we're having. So while I might see slowed alpha processing or a frontal asymmetry, That's one of the signatures. They're both signatures that may show up in depression. Those are more predictive, like one out of five, one out of three people, maybe, you know? So I'd have to see a whole bunch of like little hints and go, you know, this is like frontal asymmetry, a lot of alpha on the left front, not as much in the right front, and your whole alpha waves are slowing down. You know, sometimes, you know, less than half of the time, when this shows up, people's mood isn't resilient or buoyant all that much. You know, some history of that. And if you're like, oh yeah, actually kind of history of depression. Oh, it might be related. We'll see what happens if we train that. And we might get there as a target. More often what I find in terms of like addressing depression is that, think about like going to the gym for the first time. You know, if you do some whole body workouts for a few months, all kinds of things change. Mm-hmm. You know, like your sleep's amazing. You didn't go to the gym for your sleep. So often the way that I work on these core features, I mean, Sturman discovered this thing called SMR, sensory motor rhythm. All mammal brains make SMR and we use them to relax and inhibit. So if you've seen a cat lying on a windowsill, you've seen SMR, liquid body, very still, laser-like focus, motorically inhibited, mentally poised is the SMR state. And predators do it a lot for obvious reasons. That's the best state to leap into action from. Humans don't do a huge amount of it in these giant surges. We do it to inhibit seizures. All mammal brains do. It's also used in sleep regulation. It's called sleep spindles or sigma by neurologists. But Sturman trained it up because it was obvious. And it turned out it has this massive inhibitory tone kind of relationship thing. So when you start off neurofeedback in this SMR end of the pool, you get broad regulation, sleep, attention, stress. Those are actual core features. A lot of the time, even significant depressive stuff will lift pretty dramatically when you're sleeping amazingly well, you're not anxious, you know, or at least you have control over it. You're, you know, like sometimes the depression's a reaction to anxiety. It's an agitated depression. You're burnt out into depression. Or it's an exogenous cause depression. You can't sleep, which is endogenous, but like, you know, it's a secondary cause, a secondary depression, let's say, or it's secondary to ADHD because you can't sleep, or secondary to, you know, something else, some trauma. And if you take care of all the other circuits, what I find is that a lot of brains have that righting motion, that resiliency, that buoyancy, kind of like a weeble wobble. If you're, you know, our age, or a sailboat, if you're, you know, younger and don't know what a weeble wobble is, that little thing that springs up and won't get knocked over. Our mood, our emotion, our energy, our decision-making capacity, our joy, our interest should all have a righting motion, a resiliency, a buoyancy. And you see the lack of that in some people in an alpha asymmetry and slowed alpha waves. But again, not diagnostic. I wouldn't go, oh, mood issue. I would go, oh, okay, worth checking with this guy to see if this is something he wants to go at, see if it's real. And even if you say, oh yeah, that's real for me, I wouldn't know if this particular set of features in the brain map are what's causing it. I would just go, okay, now we have a target. Let's see what happens. It's not one of the more reliable things, but I would also have some confidence that depression will work itself out for most people as we get you rock solid on those other resources. So,
fascinating, to say the least. So I guess I have a couple of questions. So this is not... Is it more than just insurance in terms of billing, or is this just too fringe for psychiatrists and the mainstream medicine?
The mix. It used to be covered better. You alluded to this sort of transformation that has gone on in the past 30 years in mental health, and dead bang on. I assume Canada has echoed the US in sort of the way things have changed and how they haven't, you know, necessarily figured out mental health any better than we have. But the insurance reimbursement is quite poor for neurofeedback, is a short answer. Just like most psychotherapists aren't really taking insurance anymore, they're out of pocket and, you know, pay these days. Same thing is true of mostly of neurofeedback. Most people in the field of neurofeedback are therapists, or at least kind of treat it like a therapeutic, psychological, you know, medical kind of experience. And so they bill therapy rates. You know, people charge $150 to $300 an hour. In New York City, it's higher. Bay Area, it's higher, you know. But we have a gym model, so we don't charge that rate. We charge, you know, half that or less, basically. And we also do it all virtually if you need to. So we send you gear. We have coaches who work with you. We set up your brain maps live. We walk you through data gathering. We teach you how to use hardware. We have live coaching programs, a check-in sort of chat private to you so you can check your electrode placements or do troubleshooting of your software. We have, you know, training logs. It's a personal training experience. And so I'm a bit of a disruptor in this space, trying to be an evangelist to say, no, you should be doing this yourself. And so I don't take insurance. We do super bills and other documentation of expenses if people want to pursue reimbursement, but it's just so poor. You know, I mentioned I used to co-run this addiction center called Alternatives, and we would submit verification of benefits to all the insurance companies for clients who came in for addiction work. We'd always get back a, oh, sure, 30% kind of, 40% kind of, you know, estimate. We never got reimbursement for neurofeedback. I'm not sure we ever even paid the billing person's salary per year on the money that came back in. It was absurd. So the field of neurofeedback, I have a friend who recently retired in this part of Southern California, and he was getting, he was, you know, one of these psychologists, clinical psychologists, multiple degrees, multi-board certified on every single insurance panel, 50 years in practice, knows how to dot every I, cross every T, and get every dollar squeezed out of the system. For the past few years, for his clients coming in three times a week, he was getting $35 once a week reimbursed. So it's a bit of a uphill battle, and our solution at Peak Brain is to drop our prices, thrust the agency back onto you, teach you to read your brain maps instead of tell you what they mean explicitly, provide a lot of low-cost or free resources to keep going, and make it more of an education and facilitation play for your agency instead of a treatment play, basically.
In terms of, quote, legitimacy for mainstream media, is this just seen as fringe? I mean, there must be, obviously, there's published data on studies on this.
Oh, thousands.
Is it seen as fringe, do you think?
No, I don't think it is anymore. It was when I started grad school. Like when I was applying to grad school in 2002 and 3, a kind of time frame, I got in some good ones. I mean, I got in some really good ones, but I had to sort of like be careful how I talked about things I discovered. Because if I use the word biofeedback or even neurofeedback more than once or twice, people's eyes started to roll. They got disinterested. They heard, you know, he wants to do kooky stuff. It's kind of the equivalent of going to like a neuroscience program 20 years ago and using the word consciousness. Like no one wants you. Like it's going to kill your career. It's a joke. Or maybe a physicist 5 years ago talking about artificial intelligence or aliens or something. Now it's not the worst idea, xenobiology, because we're finding water under, you know, the surface of Mars. We found an Earth-like planet 100 light years away yesterday or something. Like it's okay. That's a plausible field. But you want to study aliens in the 60s? Forget it. You can't come to our PhD program. And the same was true of consciousness. And the same was true of neurofeedback, even as late as I would say when I was applying to grad school in the 2002, 2003. But there was sort of this sea change. I mean, I had this experience maybe 4 years in, I just gathered a whole bunch of lovely data, and it was among the first double-blind placebo-controlled studies ever done in neurofeedback for obvious reasons. It's hard to do placebo EEG, but we came up with an elegant way to do it, did a lovely study. I found that the brain's figuring out what's happening within minutes the first time. But I was doing this study, and I was doing a couple other studies, and a couple of my colleagues came to me in the UCLA psych department, people I'd interviewed with, you know, years before, and they didn't think I was doing fringy things, or at least express it. They let me into the program, obviously, the department. But they came to me, these like cognitive psychologists, people like really serious big names. I don't want to put them on the spot and, you know, expose them. But they were like, hey, for your next study, can you please use my measurement tools or my model to figure out how it's changing across your interventions? Like suddenly it was the cool thing. And the NFL is using, and the NBA is using neurofeedback. And the Red Cross is using it all over Europe for refugees now. It's just getting, the uptake is huge because the technology, when I got involved in the field 20 years ago, whatever, the field of neurofeedback, the technology was super expensive. I mean, the cheapest system, I bought my first system from a psychologist and, you know, out of pocket, even before I was doing it, I gotta get one. And I spent like $2,500 for a little dinky, hard to use piece of hardware, you know, didn't come with all the things I needed. It was, you know, it was really annoying. And now you can get a complete system to train your brain. It's not the best system. You can get one for under $1,000, like almost commodity level hardware and software. And everything's so much easier to use now. So for a couple of grand, you get yourself set up with like really nice brain training gear, the same way you would for like a really nice Nautilus machine at home or a Peloton or, you know, one of those kind of things. And then you have remote coaching, at least in our company, or you go see a therapist for it, you know, in three times a week in an office. We, of course, still have offices, even in a post-pandemic world. We still have offices in California. We have two in LA and in Orange County. We have one in St. Louis, which is closer to you. If you happen to be flying, please consider yourself invited for a free brain map, Doug. Happy to host you there. We have an office in London that we partner with, and we're working on one now in Copenhagen. So we still have physical presence around the world. But at this point, I mean, in 2019, pre-pandemic, we were like, half, a little over half of our business was remote, but now it's about 3/4 or better. And we're doing some things to accelerate that. And I'll have some things to, you know, some tools we're releasing to the end of the year that'll help people, you know, do more behavioral health tracking and quantified self-tracking to plug all your data into your diet, your exercise, your fasting, your sleep, your nutrition, and your Apple Watch and your Oura Ring and everything else, and tie it all together to give you this retrospective dashboard. You can like say, oh, hey, let me see if my drinking affected my sleep last month and see, oh yeah, every Thursday when I went out a little bit later, had an extra drink, look at that, my deep sleep numbers tanked. Or Well, that meditation practice I built in 2 weeks into last month, oh my gosh, my sleep's improving, or my reported stress every day went down, or my HRV's gone up, and I'm, oh, cool. So it's just agency play again. I'm all about the agency. I'm all about giving you control, not doing it for you, you know?
So I don't want to take up a ton of your time, but I'm wondering if it's possible to describe how a person manipulates this. It's not just self-talk.
It's not at all. In fact, it's not conscious, right? Otherwise, cats couldn't do it. So that's the one thing I have, I mean, kind of dancing around, is the process of neurofeedback. It's actually deceptively simple what's happening. Going back to one of our examples, let's say you wanted to focus and we decided that meant you should have reduced theta at rest and slightly higher low beta waves at rest, which is the classic thing you do for a lot of things. I'd stick a wire on your earlobes and one on the right-hand side of your head. There's a circuit structure, if you will, that handles supervisory attention. It helps stitch together the two hemispheres that have separate attention systems into one unified experience of attention to know if you're paying attention, to pump the brakes if you're being impulsive. It's this right-hand side right here on the central motor strip, basically. And we would stick a wire on it briefly, you know, just for half an hour, and measure how much theta and how much beta you're making moment to moment on your own as you go. So high theta is like having air in the brake lines. You know, stuff gets in, you can't inhibit, it's reactive. High theta is like having a circuit activated. So whenever the theta dips on its own and the beta rises on its own for half a second, we would go, yeah, good job, brain, by making something happen on a computer screen. So a spaceship flies faster, or a Pac-Man eats some more dots, or music swells in volume, or your dragon flies in a straight line and collects more gems off the sky or something. And when your brain, the next couple of seconds, happens to move in the wrong direction, the Pac-Man stalls, the puzzle stops unfolding, the music goes away, and the brain goes, hey, I was watching information, where'd the information go? And a couple seconds later, it happens to move back in the right direction, and we start plotting it again. So this is iterative operant conditioning. The trick here is that every few seconds, we move the goalposts. So effectively, we are plotting trends the brain's engaging in, but not all the trends, just some things. So if I applaud your brain whenever it drops its theta in a little run and raises its beta, you won't have any experience of your brainwaves changing. You can't feel, why is the spaceship stopping and starting? It's so annoying or whatever, you know? But tomorrow, not right away, about 3 to 5 sessions in, you start feeling it like a workout. It starts to kick in after a while. But what happens is you'll sit in the chair for half an hour and work your brain out by just kind of watching the thing applaud you and not applaud you. And tomorrow, or maybe tonight, your brain will reach for whatever produced more input and you'll have a shift of experience. You'll sleep differently. You'll feel more focused. Your OCD will... oh, there's a volume knob there. Cool. Your trauma won't be quite as triggering or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you go, hey, I noticed this effect from that workout. We index what happened. So the brain maps gives me sort of a way to build a workout plan like a personal trainer would at Equinox. Oh, go be DEXA scan, your fitness scan, your strength, your bone density. All right, what do you want to work on? All right, let me build some workouts for you, run you through them. As things change, because as you pointed out earlier, brains are much weirder than bodies in terms of how unusual they are. So I don't know exactly what will work for you. I have a sense. I'm pretty good at, you know, getting close, but we want to hear what happens, not believe what I think. So we have you tell us how your sleep is changing, your stress is changing, your attention is changing. All these things will shift and will tell us how the workouts are landing. And as you build up sessions of training, the brain will change. And so I do in the offices, we do regular assessments every 20 sessions. And then 40 sessions of training of neurofeedback, you typically make a pretty linear change for attention, stress, and sleep. And it's a pretty, you know, that's around the permanent place. When you hit 30, 40 sessions, there's a floor pretty much under you at that point for many people. And you can build, you can do more stuff. And, you know, many people's goals are not 100% addressed around that 40 session mark. But many people's are, especially for the easy stuff, so to speak, like ADHD or some anxiety or some, you know, not complicated sleep issues. Those are actually... it's kind of like you're out of shape. You come in like, you know, middle age, anxious, burnt out, having been a football player in your high school, kind of like not sleeping well, can't concentrate, have some apnea. You're just out of shape. Your brain's out of shape. It's kind of all it is. I mean, it doesn't feel that lightweight of a thing to deal with for many of us, but that's kind of all it is for a lot of us. So you train the sleep resources, train the attention resources, train the stress management resources, which have some overlap in lower down resources themselves. So you have this like sort of shoring up the whole system effect. And as I was saying earlier, people then tend to soar. And from then you can do things like creativity work and boost your immune system. Gary Schumer, this colleague I mentioned who retired earlier, he published a paper, Dr. Schumer published a paper not too long ago, but the research was done like 15, 20 years ago on looking at alpha training with HIV positive populations. And the research was done at a time before the antiretroviral stuff, the modern medications we have, back when HIV was largely a death sentence. And he was doing, you know, like a three-arm study. One was just alpha stim, which is a mild current relaxation thing that was used a lot in the 60s and 70s, or 70s and 80s actually, neurofeedback, or both. And he did alpha training at the posterior, which is sort of akin to the relaxation work we often do these days for creativity. But he did this three-arm study, and the two arms of the study that had neurofeedback had their T cells go up and up dramatically. And he thought that was cool. He published this paper, I think in 2000, maybe like 5 or 6. And right when he was publishing it, I was finishing working with a client for something else, anxiety and creativity mostly. But he happened to be HIV positive. And I said, oh, cool. Hey, here's a paper that just came out on this stuff. And we actually just did a bunch of creativity work for you, which is kind of the next door neighbor of this protocol. You might have gotten some of these benefits, just FYI, or if you want to pursue that at some point, this is a, you know, some bit of information for you. He rushed right out and got his T cells checked, and they were like 120% of average. And 12 weeks prior, they were like 20% of average, and he was struggling a little bit. Now, that's not a permanent change. I'm not saying you can fix HIV with neurofeedback, not at all. But the relaxation response, the hypnagogic state shift, causes a massive surge in hormones, including things that upregulate the immune system. You know that moment when you're falling asleep and you have the best idea ever, or solve world hunger, or come up with the best story idea, or, you know, remember the thing to do tomorrow, and then you wake up the next morning and wait, something important. Oh, what was that thing last night? Right? That moment, that nonlinear, that creative, that access consciousness flow state is hypnagogic, basically access as we're falling to sleep. But you can train that reliably up in people, so you can get more and more ready access, that generative wellspring of ideas and emotions. And this technique is done for creativity with huge effects. There was a study in the big performing college in London. I think it was King's. I forget which one. They did a neurofeedback study with the music performance class, and the group that did the neurofeedback had a whole grade level improvement in their final project in terms of like improvisational ability and creativity. And they controlled for stage fright. It wasn't like a relaxation effect. It was something else. And I work with a lot of musicians and actors, a lot. And every single one of them, every single one, a few weeks in, is like, oh my God, you know, I'm getting such amazing creative effects. A couple of my most recent and most vocal referral sources are acting coaches right now in Los Angeles, because I've turned on a couple of their students who are struggling, who are professional actors, just got unlocked again. And they're like, what did you do? What's going on? You're amazing now. Oh, I'm doing this thing over at Peak Brain. So I'm getting, like, I'm collecting groups of actors from different shows. I love it, in different, like, you know, plays and things, because it's a huge impact on creativity. Because if you can shift in and out of a linear mode of thought, it's amazing. And this technique called alpha theta neurofeedback, used for flow and for creativity, it is the core of a bunch of other sort of second level neurofeedback programs. And it was also the core of all the Eugene Peniston work done in alcoholics, the Peniston protocol in the 60s, I think before Sturman. Peniston was doing work showing that if you trained up this hypnagogic state with alcoholics, you flip the recidivism rate of relapse of alcohol as well. So it went from, again, 3/4 down to 1/4. And I've seen that a lot. I've done a lot of work with alpha theta with alcoholics, and it gives the alcoholic reliably the downshift. So I have brain mapping data. I usually show people, but I'll explain it. If I look at the brain of a chronic burnt out, many year drinker, they're shaky, they're nervous, they're anxious, they're kind of ADHD and anxiety, can't fall asleep without a drink, this over arousal state. Mm-hmm. That brain is high in beta everywhere, and it's got high coherence or connectivity, stuck together in beta. And that person's hyper aroused. I have a bunch of brain maps of my clients in those states who've been driven to my office in a chaperone state with, like, documented, you know, months of sobriety, and just doesn't go away for months and years sometimes. And the first guy I worked with like this, the first really severe, burnt out, you know, old school alcoholic who's just not healthy in many, many ways, you know, bright orange skin and liver failure, you know, couldn't fall asleep. He needed massive drugs to knock him out. Didn't crave alcohol, oddly enough. So he was just always anxious and could never sleep. And, you know, we get kind of like disorganized mentally because of it. 2 weeks into the process of training him, I walked into the office and he's asleep on my couch. I'm like, oh, is he here for a neurofeedback visit? No. He just came in to prove he can nap now. He's super excited about it. I told him he could sleep on your couch and you're out. Oh, okay, cool. 2 weeks in, 25 years of like needing an Ativan, an Ambien, and a bottle of half a wine to shut his mind off. 2 weeks. He detoxed 45 days, 2 weeks of neurofeedback. He could fall asleep at will. And that was not uncommon when I was working with alcohol. It's a really lovely, deep tool. So the point isn't that I have magical tools for any of these things. The point is that there are agency points of change possibly available from everybody. And you can look at your brain maps, you can look at your attention tests, you can decide if there's things you want to work on, you can go after those things. You can decide if they changed by measuring the brain, by measuring the performance, by feeling it. You know, it's not about what someone's going to tell you a med will do or what the diagnostic label is you're being given or what the, you know, it's about, well, which resource are we working on? Is that changing? Are you sleeping better, deeper, less well? Are you getting stuck? Are you getting less traumatized? You know, what's going on? And that is the only criteria here for success in neurofeedback. So again, while most people do this as therapists, I really view this as personal training for obvious reasons. It's iterative. The person's perspectives, in some ways, the most important thing. And the psychologist who does neurofeedback has to, in some ways, work around that by doing therapy, by doing a lot of relational work, by doing nuanced, you know, interviews, et cetera. And so instead of me becoming a therapist or having to surmount that particular relationship piece of it, you know, I couldn't do that for 1,000 people. I could do it for 100 maybe, but I couldn't do it at scale. And I want this thing to be everywhere. So I decided to thrust the agency back onto the client. And the Peak Brain offices offer free Peak Brain maps without any charge, you know, and your listeners get a half price. So it's only $249 one of our offices to get a brain map done for your listeners. And then it's free thereafter. So you can look at your brain on caffeine or whatever else you want, or you're after your, like, you know, hyperbaric, you know, months, whatever. So we have this open-ended kind of agency thing, the same way Equinox might let you in once a year to do your, you know, fitness weigh-in or whatever. And then our training rates are way less, you know, they're less than half. So we end up providing this ongoing way to plug in to performance goals, to agency. You know, I mentioned actors and creatives, and about a third of our clients are that high level performer. You know, that actor, that musician, that CEO who's trying not to be a jerk at the end of the day, you know, because he's been in high powered mode all day, or trying to, you know, sleep less or drink less or whatever. And then we have the severe brains, the autism, the big seizure issues, the brain injuries that are quite dramatic. And then there's people like you and me who have just brains that might want to be optimized, you know, help stress regulation, attention, sleep, and tune them up. And it doesn't matter who you are. This only works if you have a brain. So, you know, you might as well work on it. What I tell people is it's not so much if your brain's going to change in your life. It will. You know, you get to steer that through modifiable behaviors, through healthy habits, through, you know, big interventions. So shift happens. Get yours, you know?
Yeah. And it's just, I think people will struggle to think it could be, if I can say, that simple, because I think people think it has to be all the self-talk, guided meditation. I mean, these are the kind of precursors, I guess, that kind of led us here. So what you're describing is fascinating because it sounds like it happens automatically without consciousness. If you're using that analogy of the Pac-Man going after the things, the brain is doing it itself. It's not through this kind of conscious guided meditation, like I said, or this guided self-talk. To me, that's fascinating because people can understand that, oh, if I do something like check my cell phone repeatedly, they understand the reward pathway and kind of changing the brain that way. But for it to happen just from looking at something.
When you were a baby flopping around trying to figure out how this thing called crawling and walking works, at some point you fired some neurons randomly and your arm went up and you were like, my arm, cool. And then you, like, manage to, like, push your shoulder up and you're like, oh, wait a minute. I can see more. There's more stuff going on. This whole, like, up 3 inches thing. This is nice. But what you didn't do is think about the unique combination of neurons that went together to put the arm in that mode.
Right.
They happened. They got rewarded. Later on, you use it voluntarily because you now had the resource starting to come up as it became organized. So you're right. This is not everything. It's not psychotherapy in a box. But what it can do is get the brain out of the way. I work with a lot of psychotherapists. I have one in particular in St. Louis I love who sends a lot of clients to us. And his colleagues were like, look, aren't you concerned they're cannibalizing your business? He's like, no. They get the brain, the people's brains out of the way. And then the therapy can really happen. He's a family systems theory guy, FSD guy. He loves the neurofeedback because the trauma, the sleep, the anxiety, the alcohol, whatever it is, the big physiological dysregulation gets really soothed away. He gets a read on how the person's been suffering physiologically, sleep, stress, et cetera. And then he can do the CBT, DBT, FSD stuff he's doing because the person's not resistant. They have inhibitory tone. They're not reactive or angry or anxious the same way. And they're sleeping better. They're learning better. So they move faster. I've seen when you add neurofeedback to anything, it works better. I get frantic calls from physical therapists of elders sometimes. Someone works with us for like a month. You know, and I get a call. What's going on over there? What do you mean? My client came in without a cane today. Okay. She's had a cane for like 20 years and she can't, now her hand's open for the first time. Okay, cool. Because you're causing massive bursts of plasticity. So these things happen. But you add neurofeedback to anything. There's a study out maybe 5 years ago showing that the motor evoked potential, the amount of energy required to fire a magnetic pulse on the hand area and make the hand jump, the motor evoked potential is sort of measurement threshold of how plastic, how fireable that tissue is. One single session of neurofeedback goes down dramatically, the amount of energy required. Hence the plasticity in one session, you can measure the difference. And that means we're getting bursts in BDNF. And back to depression, nothing that affects depression, nothing, doesn't do it. Meaning the only way you affect depression in the brain, the final way, is by raising plasticity factors, mostly in the hippocampus, BDNF. So like SSRI, serotonin. Serotonin has very little to do with depression, honestly. It has a lot to do with anxiety, has a lot to do with sexual function and gut function, has very, very little to do with depression. But if you monkey with the serotonin receptors and the serotonin neurons, you also monkey with the autoreceptors and the whole machinery has to re-regulate downstream 3, 4, 5 steps. The hippocampus has to react to that and the BDNF and the hippocampal place cell starts to get pumped out and the brain becomes more plastic and we lift depression. But this is also why exploring new environments, which taps into hippocampus place cells and causes BDNF to surge, or learning a language or new relationships, that's why they're all lifting of mood, because novelty raises plasticity. So anything that lifts depression does so by raising BDNF. Neurofeedback raises BDNF every single damn time you do it. So you get specific effects on circuits you think you're targeting, and you can do a lot of work that way, or injuries or whatever else. But you also get this broad effect. I joke, all my staff in the offices trains their brains, because why wouldn't you, right? If it works on anyone. And I joke that if you walk into Equinox, you know, all the staff has their abs hanging out. But if you walk into Peak Brain, everyone's got their like kindness and good listening skills hanging out. I have like 20 something and 30 something staff mostly, and they all have this vibe like they're 80-year-old monks. Strange, super possessed, well boundary, calm, hard to flap, you know? It's great because they do brain training and they all sleep incredibly well and feel resilient. And, you know, I work with them for 3 to 4 years and send them off to med school or grad school or whatever else it is, you know, but perfect in their resources.
So the world definitely needs, I would say, more of that kind of energy. So just to kind of wrap up, so if people who are interested and want to learn more in more detail, where can they find you and your work?
Yeah, so I'm on social media everywhere as Andrew Hill, PhD. That's the place to start. Please look me up on Instagram and, you know, everywhere else, Twitter. The company is peakbrainla.com or Peak Brain Institute, which is the same. And I'm releasing a personal website in a few days. So if you jump the gun, it's not there. But if you're in a few days, it's andrewhillphd.com. And again, for folks listening to your podcast, we always offer a discount for folks that have stuck it out and listened and are curious and want to dig more in. So the list price for brain mapping, the first brain map at Peak Brain, is $500 or $499. But it's half price for your listeners. It's only $249 to get an assessment done in St. Louis or the California offices. And then we would also offer the same discount off of any remote training program. So folks can just do it fully virtually with us, and it ends up being just a couple months of fees to have it all done in a facilitated way remotely. So let us know.
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing. So this is one of the episodes. I've had a few of them where people are going to have to kind of repeat, because there's so many amazing facts.
Sorry, have a dense.
No. It's good. It's nice and dense. So there's going to be lots for people to chew on. I know mine going to have to go back and listen. So for me, this is so fascinating, working mental health. I can't believe it's not leveraged more. And I think it's going to be it's going to take off. When you think of the changes that have happened over the past 27 years, I think we know what we've been doing hasn't largely worked and we need some new approach. So I'm pretty optimistic, I think.
I am too. I think, as I was alluding to earlier, the cost is coming down, the access is coming up. We have more tools, more tech, more AI. The democratization of medicine is happening. Neuroscience having information. I mean, I'm really excited for the fact that in a few months there'll be worldwide internet everywhere in the world with Elon Musk's, you know, cloud of satellites. Half the world has never been online. The world changed a lot in the past 40 years with the internet. What's going to happen when the other half of the world is suddenly on the internet? Like, it's all changing. I'm so excited. But my part of that is to sort of flesh out a company that sort of sits between Apple and Equinox and how we work. Like, it's, you know, tech/brain and fitness in that way. So I got to figure out what I can bring. But please, folks, come and ask me your brain questions on Twitter, on Instagram. The good ones I will put on YouTube videos. I have a YouTube channel as well, YouTube/DrHill, D-R-H-I-L. And ask me your questions. I'd love to get back into talking to you more again, sir, at some point. But until then, people can come at me directly if they have burning questions.
Great. Thanks so much for that. And we'll leave it right there.
Thank you.
Hit subscribe and get ready to expand your nutritional world, your perspective, and gain confidence in a way that you didn't know you could. And be sure to check out my website, DougCookRD.com.